I'm John Golia.
And I'm Greg Fife. And we are
the Flight Safety Detectives.
We're just two guys who have spent most of their career with the National Transportation Safety Board investigating aircraft disasters and aviation safety issues all over the world.
Yep, and this podcast is where we talk about everything from accidents, airplane technology, to the big business of aviation.
We live and breathe aviation. My co-host, John, has been in the aviation business for more than 60 years. He was the first and only airframe and power plant mechanic to get a presidential appointment to the National Transportation Safety Board.
And Greg is a former air safety investigator and GO team captain for the NTSB. He's investigated everything that flies worldwide since he started his career 40 years ago. And on top of that, he is a living Legends of Aviation inductee.
So between John and myself, we have over 100 years of aviation safety experience. It's time to buckle up because it's going to be wheels up. Let's get this show in the air.
Well, hello, John. Another episode of Flight Safety Detectives. We've got, I think, a pretty good show today. We're going to dissect a general aviation accident, a recent accident, that has a lot of lessons to be learned. But before we actually get into that particular accident, how are you doing, my friend?
All right. Hanging in here with all this virus, staying remote from everybody. Getting plenty of computer time.
Yeah, I'm getting more proficient myself. That's pretty scary.
It is. I don't have to call my grandkids as much as I used to.
Yeah, have you been out to the airport? You been doing anything exciting?
Yeah, actually, I've been doing something that I've been wanting to do for a long time. So you know that when I get a moment free, typically on Mondays and Tuesdays, although today's been, weather's horrible, I take off and go somewhere. So about 2 weeks ago, I was riding and just over the state line into New York from Massachusetts. When you go up in the Berkshires, the state line between Massachusetts and New York is sort of right there. You're right on the edge of it in some places. So I was riding by, and I saw this little airport sign with an arrow. So I banked a quick left and went into this single runway, pretty run down, little airport, and hung around with the guys. Two J3s on the airport, which that's a magnet for me because that's what I soloed in.
Oh, absolutely. Yep.
So I ended up talking to the guy who owned one of the two of them forever, and he kept trying to get me to go flying. It's a nice little feel. So I started with that one, and now whenever I go, I look on a map, and if I see little airports, I'll go stop and take a couple of pictures and talk to some people. It's a throwback to the old $10 hamburger where you would jump in the airplane and fly to an airport and then hang around with some people you didn't know.
Yep.
And then leave and just log in a little bit of time and enjoying yourself for the day. I'm doing that.
I like running across those little country bumpkin airports that got the greatest people there. You see some magnificent machines hiding in hangars and in places. And that's the epitome of aviation, you know, little strip and a couple airplanes like that. I love that.
Yep. So one of the airports was actually owned by the state. And the other one is owned by a farmer. And so he's got a big piece of real estate. And he's up in ages, and that's where I talked to the guy with the J3. And he said the farmer is working on putting that land in a trust fund so it can always be an airport. And what a great idea, because I also found two airports that were on the map that no longer exist because the guys who owned them died.
Huh.
So, and that's kind of scary because we can't really afford to lose those little fun airports.
No, that is what aviation's all about. It's one thing to land it. Of course, a big GA-type airport, but I sure like those country airports because I had flown a trip in my Comanche right before I sold it several years ago and flown down from Maryland all the way down to Florida and then was coming up the long way through Kentucky and a few other places and stopped at some great little airports just because either the name was enticing or it happened to be on my route of flight and met the nicest people, had the greatest conversation, had some pretty good food as well. And it was just, that made the trip so much more enjoyable. And I think that's what we value with general aviation and being able to do just that freedom. You know, you go out for a Sunday drive, I go out for a Sunday fly. So that's the kind of thing I really enjoy. But unfortunately, you know, general aviation, for all the benefits and all the things that you and I and many others have talked about, whether through articles or programs, podcasts, things like that, you and I are still looking at the worst side of aviation. And we run across accidents, both big and small, where you shake your head and try and figure out, after knowing all the facts, conditions, and circumstances, what was going on in that pilot's head? What was the decision-making process? What enticed that particular pilot to try to do things in an aircraft that was either beyond their own personal skill level or the capabilities of the airplane or a combination of both? And I think the accident that you and I are going to dissect today is a combination of both, plus a few other added factors in this particular event that cost two people their lives and severely injured a 17-year-old relative, a son, the son of the pilot. And it was an accident where you start reading, you start hearing, you start looking at the facts, conditions, and circumstances, and it's just frustrating because you're shaking your head going, why would you do that? Why would you make that decision? Why would you do or attempt to do that? And it's just, it is very frustrating because there was a significant loss of life and now a severely injured 17-year-old who's going to grow up basically without a father and his stepmother.
Yeah, it's terrible.
In fact, there's also a young daughter as well that is part of this mix, because this particular flight, the father and the stepmom and the 17-year-old were on their way up to go from Texas to Michigan to actually watch the daughter of the pilot compete in a cheerleading contest of some sort.
No pressure there, huh?
Well, let's get into it, and we're going to walk through this particular accident. And when we dissect this accident, we're going to walk through the factual information. The NTSB recently published its report of the facts, conditions, and circumstances. They haven't determined a probable cause yet. They did open the docket and put some information in there. And so in perusing this and then doing some additional research, John and I have been able to ferret out a few more facts that don't show up in the report, which I don't understand why, because I think they're relevant, and we'll point those out as well. But this is one of those accidents where there's a combination of factors. Well, before the airplane took off, there is issues with the pilot. There are issues with the aircraft itself with regard to maintenance. And then, of course, the operational discipline or lack thereof by the pilot in trying to conduct a flight in an aircraft that may have been beyond his own personal skills, abilities, and knowledge. But it's obvious that there were some other factors that may have influenced decision-making as well. So with that, we'll get into it. As I said, this was a single engine Cessna P210N. So it's a pressurized airplane. It was a 70s model, 78, I believe, model aircraft. And at the time, this pilot was a successful restaurateur down in Texas, hadn't flown, according to the NTSB, based on what they've been able to find, probably for over 20 years. There is some information from a relative, family relative of the pilot, who said the pilot hadn't flown in at least 10 years, but was interested in getting back into flying and had recently purchased this Cessna P210. Now, we don't know anything about the airplane per se with regard to what was found on a pre-buy inspection and that kind of stuff, because the NTSB doesn't have any of that kind of information in the public docket. There are a couple of logbook entries with regard to the airframe and the engine that said that they had been inspected, but doesn't really give a punch list with regard to the pre-buy inspection that would typically be done in buying an airplane or should have been done. And we don't know if, in fact, any kind of pre-buy inspection had been performed for this airplane and this pilot. But June 24th of 18, the airplane was on a flight from Texas up to the Detroit, Michigan area. The pilot, his second wife, and the pilot's son had boarded this airplane, had taken off, and made an en route fuel stop in Arkansas and put on a specific amount of fuel, 30 gallons each side. Now, this airplane is capable of holding 90 gallons of fuel, 87 of which is usable fuel. And John and I have talked about this, that when you put on a specific amount of fuel, it could be for a variety of reasons. He put 30 gallons on each side. And according to the person who did the fueling, they indicated that on the right tank, the fuel level was about a quarter inch below the tab or the fuel filler. They weren't really specific other than the fact that it was not topped off. And then the left tank with that 30 gallons added to whatever was in the tank was about 1 to 2 inches below the fuel filler. So it's not like they had the ultimate 90 gallons of gas with 87 usable to be using for fuel performance. And so the airplane departed, was en route. We don't know how the pilot flew this airplane with regard to fuel management in switching tanks to keep the tanks balanced and that kind of thing. All we know is from data that was retrieved from a JPI engine analyzer that the NTSB was able to extract, that the aircraft had been burning on a consistent basis, and this is based on pilot operation, that the airplane had been burning about 21 gallons an hour. And we'll talk about it later on, but that was about 4 gallons per hour more than what the ultimate fuel burn should have been. This was a turbo normalized engine. They had an STC put on it, so they were flying high, and so they could burn less gas. So with that being said, of course, the airplane takes off from its fuel stop in Arkansas heading to Michigan. And as they get into the area of the airport that they were landing at, the pilot, and listening to the ATC recording, he sounds normal. He's talking in a normal voice. He tells ATC that he's checking in at altitude. And as the airplane is entering into a descent, of course, he's coming down. He actually descends down to 2,000 feet. Up until this point, everything is nominal. Apparently, the flight progressed normally VFR. He's not IFR. He's a private pilot with no instrument rating. But apparently, he was able to conduct the flight at various altitudes between 10,000 and 12,000 feet. And at one point, it was as high as 14,000 feet. We don't know anything about oxygen on the aircraft. But because the airplane's pressurized, we assume that he understood how to use the pressurization, but that would have been taken care of. So as the airplane descends down to 2,000 feet, he's talking to an air traffic controller. He establishes contact with a tower controller at the Detroit airport. He clears the aircraft, the pilot, to land on runway 33. And as the airplane is being positioned by the pilot to make that landing, the pilot told the controller, and I'll quote out of the NTSB report, "We don't have a green light on our gear down here. We might have to circle if you don't mind." And the tower controller offered to observe the landing gear position if the pilot made a low pass or flyby over runway 33. And then the pilot does, in fact, say, "Yeah, we'll do that." And he says, "All right, looks like we're partially down. I just don't think we're all the way down. I'll try and cycle it again. We're coming over." And as he begins to fly over the airport, the controller's looking for him, sees him, and the pilot transmits, "We got a partial down tower, but it's not all the way down. We don't have a green light." The airplane was, at that point, a mile on final coming over runway 33. As the airplane continued, it did overfly the runway, and the tower controller told the pilot, "Yeah, your right main appears like it's still up." So the pilot replied, "Let's try and cycle it one more time and then cycle it down." And again, this is all happening in the vicinity of the airport, right off the departure end now of runway 33 at 800 feet MSL. So the pilot had descended low, And then as they departed off the end of runway 33, he apparently started to climb. And the controller cleared the pilot to make left traffic for runway 33. The pilot replied that he was doing so. And as he was making a climbing left turn, the pilot asked the tower, should we just keep circling out here while we work on the gear? The controller said, yeah, you can just keep circling out there and make low approaches over the runway as you work on the gear, stay in the traffic pattern. And again, we don't know exactly what was going on with the pilot and what they were trying to do to remedy the situation. But several minutes later, the pilot transmitted to the controller, doesn't appear we're making any progress with the gear whatsoever. At that point, the airplane had already climbed now to 2,000 feet, and the pilot began a left turn from a downwind leg to a base leg for runway 33. And he's, I think at that point, better than a mile off the end of the runway when he does that. The controller asked the pilot, what are your intentions? And the pilot replied, quote, well, if we can't make anything happen, I guess we can land in the grass just on the infield there, just parallel with runway 33. And while that sounded good, the controller ended up replying that he did not prefer a landing on the grass infield and suggested that the pilot land on runway 725 instead. And the pilot asked the controller, so, you know, the west side isn't any good. We can't land in the grass. The controller says, I can't clear you for a landing there. But if that's where you have to put it down, you think it would be better to land in the grass than on the runway? By then, the pilot had climbed the airplane back up to about 2,500 feet NSL and was flying northbound parallel to runway 33 and was almost a mile east of the runway. He does talk to the tower again and then asks the controller, hey, do you want me to land on runway 7? And the pilot says, yeah, continue entering a downwind leg for runway 7, clear to land on runway 7, and I'll see if I can get you some equipment out there if you want to just keep circling until I can get some equipment out. So the controller, again, there's nothing in the pilot's voice because I was listening to the audio, as I know John was, and he sounds relatively normal. Just matter of fact, can't get the gear down. We got this issue. We can't land in the grass. You want me on another runway? And while the controller is, again, doesn't sense anything, so he says, yeah, if you can just circle out there, I'll get some equipment out there. And if you're going to land on the runway, you'll be prepared for a response by emergency response. Well, just as the controller had made that statement about just keep circling until I can get some equipment out there so you can land on 7, the pilot comes back and says, quote, well, I just burned out of fuel. We're totally out, bud. And apparently just that statement wasn't enough to really get the controller thinking about, is he saying that we have a total engine failure or whatever? Because the controller responded, okay, well, I don't want to keep you circling either out there. So runway 7 clear to land. And at that point, based on radar data, the airplane had descended now down to 1,800 feet and was almost a mile north-northeast of runway 15, or actually it was runway 25 displaced threshold and 1.75 miles north of runway 7 displaced threshold. Now, it's evident from the ATC tape that the controller was watching the airplane when he made that statement that, you know, you're clear to land on 7. He watched the airplane and apparently something triggered him to believe that the airplane had gone down because he started making radio calls in the blind to the pilot, and there were multiple radio calls with a sense of urgency, and unfortunately there was no response. And where the airplane went down was better than just about a mile from the runway 7 displaced threshold. And when you think about it, he's still a good distance off from the airport. The airplane crashed in a pretty much vertical attitude into the ground in a vacant residential area, And the NTSB did their on-scene investigation. They made some findings. Of course, the airplane, when it struck the ground, exploded and burned. And that's a key thing to remember. John and I are going to talk about it here in a minute, but that's a key thing to remember. And the fire significantly damaged the aircraft. Now, the 17-year-old boy who was able to survive was sitting in the very back of the airplane. He had slept most of the flight and woken up just as they were getting ready to land. He heard his dad talk about the fact that they had run out of gas. And his interview, he was able to extricate himself out of the burning wreckage with the help of some folks that had responded when they saw the airplane crash. He was significantly burned. But the airplane then was consumed all the way back to the empennage by the post-crash fire. The pilot and the front seat passenger, which was his wife, had succumbed to multiple blunt force trauma in the fire. The board, in looking at the wreckage on scene, found that the flaps were in the 10-degree extended position and that the landing gear, they were able to determine that the nose wheel and the right main landing gear were in the fully extended and locked position. The left gear had remained in the up and locked position. And again, that's a key finding because if you remember, I said that the controller reported it looked to him like it was the right main landing gear that was still up, when in fact, it was the left main landing gear that was up. The board also noted in its examination of the wreckage that the fuel selector valve was on the right fuel tank, and that they had done a functional test of the valve, and it didn't reveal any anomalies. Apparently, it was in the detent, and things were copacetic for it to be drawing fuel from the right tank. And there was some minimal damage to the propeller, probably windmill damage, if the engine had actually completely failed and was then the prop was just windmilling. And so those key findings from the wreckage itself at the accident site kind of support the fact that, okay, he did have a gear problem of some sort. Don't know at that point what it was, but the NTSB removed the main landing gear actuators and had them examined post-accident. And John will get into the findings of that, but there was an issue with the downlock switch for the left main landing gear. So that was a critical finding from the wreckage. But in going through the report itself, there was some very disturbing information about the pilot in this aircraft. And the pilot, as I said, hadn't flown in quite a long time, and there was no logbook found by the NTSB. It is apparent that somehow this pilot may have gotten insurance on the airplane because there was an issue with the aircraft that on a flight. Now, he bought the airplane. We don't have the actual paperwork, but it's apparent from some of the electronic data that the board recovered that this pilot had owned the airplane approximately 2 months and had been flying it. And in that two-month period, based on recorded data from his Stratus that he used for his flight planning, there were 8 flights, and those flights averaged out to about a total of 16 hours of total time in 2 months in the airplane. Now, in looking at the pilot's history, the board, in its report, made some observations and had dug up some information from the pilot records at the FAA. At the time, the pilot had a medical that had been issued in 2017. Now, this was a June 2018 accident. So he had a third-class medical, so technically he was, as far as currency in the medical was concerned, he was current with a medical. We don't know anything about his piloting currency. The board came up with a previous medical, which was the 17 medical, that the pilot indicated he had 650 hours of total time with 0 hours within the previous 6 months. Now, that right there is a flag because, of course, that's going to, you know, indicate, okay, well, if he hasn't had any time in the last 6 months, then we have to be looking at flight reviews, currency, proficiency, and things like that. And then, of course, the board reviewed other medical certificates that he applied for, and it's quoted right out of the report. A review of previous medical applications revealed that the pilot did not report any flight time during the 20-year period before his current medical application in 2017. So there's a validation that this pilot had not been flying at all. He gets a medical in 17. There is no indication, at least available to the board through a logbook or anything, what kind of recurrency flying, proficiency flying he had gotten in any aircraft, let alone this 210. And unfortunately, there is no information in the docket nor cited in the report by the board of any information that the pilot may have produced to the insurance company when he got insurance on this new airplane, this B210. That would have been a place I would have immediately gone to see what he told the insurance company, because an airplane such as this, it is a complex airplane, it is a pressurized airplane, and they're going to require certain minimums as far as not only total time, but recency of experience, pilot in command, and of course, proficiency in an airplane such as this. There is no discussion about that in the NTSB report. And of course, trying to peruse the internet, there's nothing available there. All we know is that this pilot hadn't flown in quite a long time. He purchases a very complex airplane. We have no understanding, or at least based on the NTSB report, and whether they actually tried to track down the previous owner to see if he gave this accident pilot any kind of instruction or training, or anybody else had flown with this pilot to give him any training in this airplane. There is no discussion about that, no history that's currently available through public means. So those are question marks. As an investigator, I would have been tracking down insurance information. I would have been talking to the previous owner in the sale of the aircraft, and then tried to find out if anybody had flown with the accident pilot in this 16-hour period over 2 months, whether it was as a safety pilot or instruction or a combination of both. Because you don't just jump back into an airplane after 20 years and think that it's like riding a bicycle, you can make it happen. And all of this information was confirmed by not only a family member of the pilot who made a statement that he hadn't flown in the last decade, but also apparently this kind of discussion had come up between the accident pilot friends. And the fact that he hadn't flown this airplane, and one of his friends said, I don't think Greg needs to be flying that airplane until he learns it. I mean, those are kind of telling statements that don't appear in the official report by the NTSB, which would suggest that the cousin and these friends were never interviewed. That's critical information that plays into the causal factors that had an adverse effect on the operation of this aircraft. Now, going through the report, of course, there is a lot of data extracted from these electronic means. There's some information in the docket with regard to the previous fueling operation by the FBO. So we substantiate that. There is some additional information with regard to the maintenance. And there is a key statement that I'll read that John's going to talk about. But one of the key statements that was put into the report by the NTSB was a description of the engine. And it talks about what they found in the post-accident investigation. But again, the pilot was told, as the owner of the aircraft, by a mechanic And it's written in the report, and this is a very telling statement. It says, the pilot reported to his insurance company, and I'm quoting this out of the NTSB report. The pilot reported to his insurance company that the oil gauge rod fractured on May 6, 2018. This is a little over a month before the accident flight. During a flight from one airport to another in Houston, Texas, the pilot consulted an aviation mechanic who found the fractured oil gauge rod after the pilot reportedly had an issue getting the oil filler cap to seat properly. The mechanic stated that when he removed the oil filler cap, there was only about 2 inches of the oil gauge rod still attached, and that he was able to extract another 3 inches of the oil gauge rod from the tube. The mechanic stated that a borescope inspection revealed tick marks on the inside surface of the crankcase. The oil filter was removed and cut open to check for metal contamination. The mechanic reported that the oil filter contained significant metal debris and that he told the pilot that the engine needed to be overhauled. The pilot told the mechanic that he had just purchased the airplane and that he could not afford to overhaul the engine. The mechanic then placed a red, quote, do not fly, end quote, placard on the pilot's side yoke. The mechanic stated that a couple of weeks later, the pilot returned with another oil filter for inspection. The pilot told the mechanic that he had researched online how to remove metal from an engine by flushing it with diesel fuel. The mechanic stated that there was no metal present when he cut open the oil filter for the inspection. The mechanic again told the pilot he should not fly the airplane until the engine had been overhauled. When you read statements like this, and John and I are going to discuss this shortly, that is a very telling tale about how this sequence of events started, the attitude of the pilot as the owner of the aircraft, and some of the issues that had an adverse influence on pilot decision-making. And in fact, the post-accident examination did find metal debris in the crankcase when they dissected the engine after the accident.
Good morning, John the Ground, Canadian 920. We're just coming up to Alpha Juliet.
A920 runway 248 taxi. North.
One of the other things that the NTSB wrote, the investigator wrote in his report in the additional information, was the fact that the pilot failed to, or at least the way it's stated, is that 14 CFR 91.151 that deals with the specific VFR fuel requirements were likely not met, which would imply that the board is saying that the pilot didn't have enough fuel on board the aircraft. Well, we're going to talk about that here because that wasn't necessarily correct. And so with that being said, I'll let John jump in and talk about some of the maintenance issues, because John, one of the issues that really started this whole sequence of events was that May 6th event with the oil filler cap and the dipstick.
Without a doubt. I could just imagine what the mechanic that told him not to fly this airplane is feeling about now with all this coming out. He must have felt pretty bad the day of the accident, and he's probably been weighing on him ever since. And now this will just refresh all those wounds as far as the mechanic's concerned. Because here's a guy who's using his skills, his knowledge, and he says you best not fly this airplane because the outcome is not going to be good. And we have an owner that jumps in and takes the airplane away. Now, the fact that he had to hang a tag on this airplane tells me that he didn't have the logbooks. You know, some pilots carry the logbooks in their flight bag. They don't leave them on the airplane. And it sounds like he brought the oil filter to the mechanics. That meant the airplane was somewhere else. Maybe it was in the area, maybe it wasn't. But bringing the filter to him He denies the mechanic the ability to take a look at the engine himself. So he flushed out all the debris out of the crankcase. Doesn't mean he solved the problem. What underlying problem there was to cause metal in the crankcase was not addressed. It was just cleaned out. So that's the first step that is a mistake on the part of the pilot.
John, let me just jump in and take us back. So this guy, the pilot, takes the airplane to the mechanic, says he has a problem putting the dipstick back in. The mechanic finds that the dipstick's broken off, and he's finding parts in there. He does his examination with the borescope. He sees that, you know, there's evidence that it's been ingested into the engine. As the engine's been run, of course, it's making all sorts of metal inside the engine from probably beating up on the pistons and the crank and everything else. He finds metal in the oil filter, and he tells the pilot owner, you can't fly this airplane until you get the engine overhauled. Okay, so he puts the tag on the pilot's control yoke. Okay, so what? I mean, what other legal things or ramifications does the mechanic, or what legal authority does the mechanic have to basically ground that airplane?
He really doesn't. Really doesn't. If he had the logbook, he could put an entry in that would require some other, action, some further action. But without having the logbook available to write it up, he really doesn't have much. The owner-operator is responsible for the airworthiness of his airplane.
How would the mechanic return that airplane to service? Because he technically did maintenance on it, correct?
That's correct. There's a little bit of ambiguity in the rules right here. He's performing maintenance because he's looking at an oil filter. And verbally told it came off that airplane. He has no proof that it came off that airplane. He obviously doesn't have the airplane right there in front of him, but it must be on the field.
And I've done accidents where when the logbooks haven't been available, the work order states right on, the mechanic has stated right on the work order, examined this, inspected this, maintained this. This airplane is not returned to service, which again becomes part of the legal process of whether or not that airplane has been returned or not returned in an airworthy state. And in this case, it's evident when the pilot gets the information and the mechanic puts that tag on the control yoke, do not fly this airplane. That's implied that this airplane is no longer airworthy until this particular action is done.
Right, but without having it entered in the logbook, it's take the tag off and nobody knows the difference.
Okay, but what about the moral obligation?
Well, there is a moral obligation, and there may be, in a court of law, you may go after that. But he did everything available to him at that time because he didn't have access to the logbooks. So it's going to be, legally, there could be a big tug-of-war on this. And this is why most mechanics need to have liability insurance, because especially just for your legal fees, because the cost to defend in this kind of action, there was a known defect, even though he went and put a tag on it. Can it be argued that he should have done more? And the cost of defending on that kind of argument could be quite high. So maintenance people that are working out there on the field by themselves definitely need to have liability insurance.
Okay, so now step two of this that you were talking about was the fact that apparently the pilot went away, apparently did some research on the internet on how to clean out metal out of the engine, and it's implied, based on the way the report is written, that this pilot, having found that if you flush the engine with diesel fuel, you can clean out the metal, and it is apparent, based on, again, the way this is written, that this pilot may have done something to that effect. He had an oil filter on there, so he put the oil back in the engine. He ran this engine, or, whether it was underground or fluid, took that oil filter off, took it back to the mechanic and said, hey, inspect this one. And the mechanic said, yep, there's no metal in it, but you still got to have this engine overhauled. I mean, it doesn't change the fact of what I found from the previous time you were here. Just because you flush any kind of loose metal possibly out of it doesn't mean that it has corrected the problem. And, oh, by the way, you've induced some damage from having ingested that oil dipstick that could be catastrophic, whether or not that engine is making metal.
That's true. The mechanic at that point in time cannot tell what the metal shavings that he found in the filter, the source of them. Were they just the dipstick grinding itself up inside the engine, or is it in fact the engine dying?
Yeah.
It was a low time engine. I think it was 65 hours or something like that.
Yeah. And so when you think about it making metal, I mean, it could have been a bearing coming loose because it ingested that dipstick. It could have been cam lobes, could have been crankshaft. It could have been all sorts of stuff. You just don't know.
Right.
So now this guy has come back a second time. What kind of recourse, I mean, what kind of liability does that mechanic have? He opened up the oil filter, say, yeah, you don't have any metal in it. Apparently made the statement, I don't care if you don't have any metal, you can't fly this airplane because you need the engine overhauled. Would you, should you have documented that? Should the mechanic have documented that in some way, shape, or form?
Well, without access to the logbook, the only source he had to, or means he had available to him to document it was, in fact, putting a tag on the control column. He doesn't have control of the airplane. It's the owner operator. And that's why the FARs require the pilot or the operator of the airplane or the owner to be responsible for the airworthiness. Because the mechanic, you know, in this case, was it 1 day, 1 week, or 1 month between the time he hung the tag on and when it was next flown? The report doesn't say that, but with the mechanic without access to the logbooks, he's very limited in what he can do. You go out there and put the boot on the landing gear, there's a limit on what a mechanic can do at that point in time. That's why the owner-operator is responsible.
And in fact, there is a federal aviation regulation, multiple federal aviation regulations, but one in particular that gives that responsibility to the operator, that whether it be the pilot, but presumably the pilot, but the owner as well. It says, 91.7 says, no person may operate a civil aircraft unless it is in an airworthy condition. And this airplane was clearly, at least by the mechanic, not in an airworthy condition, and apparently wasn't returned to service in an airworthy condition. Yet the accident pilot owner chose to ignore that and attempt to operate the aircraft in an unairworthy condition.
You know, everything here points to this guy has to go flying. He has to get this airplane to Detroit. He's got to go see his daughters perform. And that kind of pressure, self-imposed pressure, more often than not, leads to problems. We see it here, affecting the decision-making. You know, every step of the way, the decision-making, decision-making. When he leaves and is going on this trip, you know, the one of the things that keeps jumping out at me is the fuel. You know, taking on the fuel, calling, why didn't he fill the tanks? He was almost there. Why didn't he just ensure that he filled the tanks?
Yeah, I mean, there was only two, three people. We don't know how much baggage he had, but I can't imagine it was much. That airplane would have been capable to top the tanks off and fly. But again, we don't know how he flew. He could have taken off on one tank and then inadvertently run one dry and thinking, I ran out of gas. I mean, he said he burnt all of his fuel. Well, I mean, that was a heck of a lot of gas. That's 87 gallons. There should have been gas on board. And in fact, it's obvious there was a substantial amount of fuel, because where the airplane crashed in a vacant lot, it didn't hit a house and burn up because it hit a structure or anything. That was a fuel-fed fire from the airplane. And so it's obvious that there was a substantial amount of fuel on the aircraft. I mean, did he have time to go through the emergency procedures and switch tanks? Did he turn on a boost pump? Did he actually switch tanks? Did he run it out of, was he flying on the left tank and ran it out of gas? He turned to the right tank, but didn't have a fuel boost pump on, didn't have enough altitude. didn't have enough windmilling to get the engine started again. I mean, there's a number of possibilities. All we know is he made the statement, I burned all my gas.
Yeah, he had to switch tanks at least once. And at what point he switched them is not known. You know, the way he flew this airplane, it looks like around 21 gallons an hour. All the airplane published data shows it around 17, 18 gallons an hour.
Yeah.
So he burned a little more fuel, about 20% more than what the manufacturer says would be normal.
Yeah.
He still should have had much. It was just over a three-hour flight, 3 hours and a few minutes. So that's, even the way he flies the airplane, he was consistently at 21, occasionally at 22. So let's give him 22. That's 66 gallons of fuel that he used out of a potential of 87 gallons. So there should have been 20 gallons left in one tank or the other. If he ran it out of fuel, the way it sounds on the tape, that his engine quit because he let it run out and he was on whichever tank he was on, was empty. That meant that there's about 10 gallons or more in the other side.
Yeah.
Did he forget it? The pressure? We don't know the state going on. His son didn't indicate that he was under a lot of stress. The voice doesn't show a lot of stress. So his decision-making was way off for some reason.
Yeah. And when you think about it, John, where that was happening, you know, a mile off the end of the runway, he's already low. He's already low airspeed. He's got 10 degrees of flaps and partial gear hanging. He's got a lot of drag out there. He's got to push the nose down and get to his best glide speed to maintain that airplane flying. Who knows what he did there? It's obvious that he lost control of the airplane at some point, and because of the impact attitude, it's evident that it was probably some sort of stall with a significant pitch down low to the ground that didn't afford him any kind of at least nose-up recovery, and he struck the ground almost vertical. The thing that really concerns me is that the board focused on 91.151 about not having enough fuel on board. Well, that's not necessarily true, because as you and I, just doing some cursory, even if the left tank wasn't all the way full, let's say the left tank, as they indicated, 2 to 3 inches below the tab. Okay, so let's call it 8 gallons short in that particular tank. And let's say the right tank was absolutely full. I mean, you still had enough fuel in there since he was in close proximity to the airport, I would think, to be able to switch that fuel tank, get the engine restarted, and make it to the airport. But the bigger issue is this guy had to know if he was that fuel critical, because when he said, I burnt all my fuel, if he had that understanding, why is he out there screwing around with the landing gear multiple times? Why didn't he declare an emergency and say, I've got a gear problem and I'm fuel critical, and just directly beeline to the airport and put the airplane down?
Almost his last conversation with the tower, he was 8.8 miles from the airport. And then the accident occurred. He was almost a mile away from the airport.
Yes.
So he's going away. He's going the wrong direction.
Yeah. Yeah. And instead of flying the pattern, you know you got a critical situation. You're already low. The last thing you want to do is fly away. I mean, you beeline right to the airport. You get it as close to the airport as possible, not the furthest away. And you don't have to fly standard patterns and all the other stuff. You declare an emergency. Dude, I've got a problem. I'm coming in. I want to land. And the controller is going to accommodate you. And like he kind of implied, if you think the grass is the best place for you to land, land. But if you declare the emergency, of course, you know, the regulations say that the pilot is the final authority and they can deviate from any regulation or instruction to handle the emergency. All he had to do is just say, I'm in an emergency situation, and boom. He could have landed in the grass, could have landed on the runway. Didn't matter.
In some ways, this guy had a lot going for him, and it just points to poor decision-making repeatedly.
Yeah. Look, he buys an airplane. We don't know exactly how much training he got in it, how familiar, it's obvious he wasn't that familiar with it. He did understand enough to get the airplane flying and make it from point A to almost point B. But you have, I believe, a little bit of ego involved here. He's flying an airplane he knows he shouldn't be flying, and he's flying it anyway. He circumvented what was told to him by a professional mechanic to go off and do his own thing anyway. And then when you look at the regulations that the board doesn't talk about, and the fact that they really didn't ferret out his history and that kind of stuff, but when you look at it, 61.2 talks about exercise of privilege. Given the fact that he hadn't flown in a heck of a long time, 10, if not 20 years, you got to ferret out, how did this guy get current again? What kind of proficiency? What kind of training? Was he capable of flying this airplane? Again, I still don't understand how he would have gotten any kind of insurance on this airplane by just telling the insurance company he's got 650 hours of total time and hadn't flown in years. There's just no way. I mean, when every time I get insurance, they want to know how much time and make and model. I mean, when I had the Comanche, you had to have a minimum. I had to give instruction in my Comanche a minimum of 10 hours if somebody wanted to fly it. And I had to have so much retract time and complex aircraft time. So I want to know what this guy put on his insurance application. That should have been one of the first documents the NTSB got to try and determine whether or not he was actually current and qualified to be flying the airplane. With regard to the NTSB, they left blank 6156, which is the flight review. Again, that flight review is a requirement in order for you to fly legally as a pilot. And again, what did he do to satisfy that requirement? And then, of course, 91.3, responsibility and authority of the pilot in command. I mean, paragraph A sums it up, and that is the pilot in command of an aircraft is directly responsible for and it's the final authority as to the operation of the airplane. That right there, he's flying an unairworthy airplane. He didn't do a very good job pre-flight, basically his fuel management, if that is in fact the case, that he ran out of gas or failed to properly ensure he had sufficient fuel to complete the flight. I mean, these are elements that, yeah, you can't say, well, 91.3 caused the accident or 91 this caused the accident. It is a systemic, basically, summary of this pilot's attitude, like you were just talking about. Part of it is ego. Part of it is get there itis. That is, we've got the need to go. They've put self-induced pressure on to complete the flight. You can make a case for even 91.13, careless and reckless. Why? Because it was his reckless manner. It was his reckless decision-making that put them in a position of jeopardy, especially in a sick airplane. Pre-flight actions, 91.103. is again another one of those issues. But the biggest thing I come back to, John, is you got a problem. He's out there turning circles, trying to screw around with this landing gear. And meanwhile, he's burning lots of gas. You know what? Don't fly away from the airport. Declare an emergency and get the airplane on the ground. You got insurance. It's evident you got insurance because the board said that he had talked to the insurance company about this. Who cares? Damage the airplane, but walk away. Who cares? The insurance company will fix it.
Yes, it defies description. And screwing around, I mean, we've seen it over and over in airline accidents where they focus on the event, the problem. So here he's got a landing gear problem, focused on it, and ran out of fuel. United Airlines, Portland, Oregon. Landing gear problem.
Yeah, that's a perfect example. Yes.
Eastern Airlines in the Everglades, a light bulb. Focus on the light bulb. So we've seen that over and over in big airplanes, and it probably happens just as often or even more often in little airplanes. We just don't have the ability as accident investigators to dig it out because there is no voice recorder and no flight data recorder. So, but it probably happens more often than we realize?
Well, the saddest part of this is he had his family on board, and he basically knowingly put them in a position of jeopardy even before they took off. And while the metal in the engine was not necessarily a cause or a contributing factor, it all started with this landing gear and presumably ended with fuel starvation or exhaustion, whichever you want to look at it. The fact is he put his family in a position of jeopardy well before this flight ever started. That airplane should have never left the ground until it was properly inspected and maintained.
Yes.
And then returned to service as it needs to be.
But the fact that you're going to probably pull the engine off the airplane and take it down to find where the metal was being made, because even if it was metals coming from the dipstick, you don't know what other damage was done. So he's going to be paying for a teardown on an engine that only had 65 hours on it.
But you know what, John? I had a prop strike. I had a pilot flying my airplane, struck a taxiway light. So when I talked to the insurance company, I told him, I said, yeah, he struck this taxiway light. It didn't damage the prop, and he didn't have any kind of instant stoppage, but I want the engine torn down because I don't know what kind of internal damage he may have made. And so they ended up doing a teardown of the engine. Now, at the time, I worked it out with the insurance company to do an overhaul since the engine was all taken apart, but they paid for the teardown. So in this particular instance, I think it's telling. If you have enough money to buy this airplane, then you should have enough money to maintain this airplane. And for that pilot to tell the mechanic, I can't afford an overhaul, which is going to justify my reason for not doing it, and I'm going to find some non-monetary reason to try and fix this engine, that's the most ridiculous thing that could happen. That's like buying a car and then not having enough money to either put gas or oil in it and drive it till it stops. I mean,
that, yep, defies description. The final piece of the puzzle is why the landing gear didn't come down. And I hope the NTSB talks some more about that, because that does bother me. The airplane hasn't been out of an inspection. Just, the last 100 hours was recent. And it hadn't flown a lot, so it'd be nice to know, it'd actually be important to know, just what was going on with that gear lock.
Well, the problem is that that's the final report that's already out. So their work is done. And I think that is a key component. They do talk about in one of the documents in the report, and I think they even mentioned it in factual, that, the previous maintenance inspections that had been done, the first time the gear had been cycled 4 times. Okay, great, it worked. And then supposedly it had been cycled some 20 times. And it's obvious that the landing gear worked. Now, there was some modifications or some maintenance done on that gear. They had to change a diode in the power pack or something that operated the gear, things like that. And it's obvious that the gear worked appropriately during the fuel stop in Arkansas. But the question is, why all of a sudden did this thing get hung up? How did that uplock get bent to jam it so that it was in a closed position, or the plunger switch was in a closed position, which didn't allow the gear to release or the lock to release? Something with that gear, the way it transited up into the wheel well, had to have damaged that as it was seating in the retract cycle. I mean, those are the kinds of things. Is that a systemic problem, or is that an isolated event? If it's a systemic problem, is there a history of that happening? If there isn't a history, but it is, a problem that could happen, then where's the recommendation by the NTSB that that kind of situation be examined and remedied?
One of the things as a mechanic that you do when you find a problem with an airplane is to look back to see if anybody had done any work on it. And in this case, we find a problem with the latch, and we look back and we find out that there was some work done on it. So now that raises some red flags with that work that I don't see here in the report. They just went over lightly. And it gets back to, I think I just said it either in the last podcast or the one before, one of the frustrations that I had for all the years that I was with the board was whenever it comes to a maintenance issue, they just bring it up to the hangar doors and said, oh, maintenance made a mistake, and walk away. No detailed analysis, no going in to find out whether the human factors that were involved in it or mechanical factors that were involved in it that led to that error. Were the manuals good manuals? Did the people understand them? You know, there's a whole host of issues that should be looked at, just like we look at them in the cockpit. We analyze pilot mistakes up and down, backwards and forwards, but mechanic mistakes, we go up to the hangar door and say, yep, mechanic made a mistake, that's it, and walk away. And this is a good example of that.
What do you think a takeaway is for maintenance folks? You know, you have a pilot, you have an owner brings an airplane in, this kind of issue exists where they're going, dude, you can't really do anything with this airplane until you get it fixed. The question is, how should a mechanic protect him or herself? Like you said, they don't have the logbook. So you've got to document this somehow to protect yourself and say, I told this guy. I mean, if I go in and just interview you, you could say any old thing. But if you can show me a document, it's like, yep, here, I gave this to the pilot or I gave this to the owner saying, you can't fly this airplane until it's fixed. What should a mechanic be doing?
You know, I struggled with this as I read it. Go on. You know, so do you call the local FAA and tell them? Sometimes the FAA people don't want to hear it or don't understand it. Or there's a whole host of reasons on that side. Do you call the FAA 800 number that's recorded? And you just say, I worked on someone's airplane and I found it to be unairworthy. And I was unable to access the logbooks. So I informed the owner-operator, and that's all I could do. I don't know the answer to that fully, and that's going to be something I'm going to look into. What I would do is I would do something to make sure that someone other than myself and the owner knows what has transpired. You got to have some independent source that knows. Now, we don't know what kind of facility this guy worked in. Was it the FBO? Was it a maintenance organization that's part of the FBO or even an independent 145, so then he would have a means of recording it, which would at least relieve him of some of the responsibility. So it's a wide open area that needs to be discussed.
Well, I think the biggest takeaway is that if you're going to take your aircraft to a professional, that is a mechanic, and they tell you that based on their examination, their inspection, that something needs to be fixed, repaired, or replaced before you fly this airplane, you need to heed that advice. Because, one, you're paying them for their expertise. They examine, they inspect, they tell you you have to repair or replace a particular component, part, or in this case, you have to have that engine inspected or overhauled before you fly it. That is what you're paying for to make an informed decision. I mean, if you're just going to ignore them because you can't afford it, then why even go there?
Yep. And who knows what he told his wife? You know, we buy this airplane so we can fly around. We can go up to Michigan and see our daughter. I mean, it's all sorts of open-ended questions here. It really is a tragedy. I feel for this family.
Yeah. I would really like to see how he was able to get insurance. Because, again, my experience, and, you know, I think insurance is absolutely necessary when it comes to this kind of thing. I know what the requirements are that I've had to meet, as well as others that I've put on my policy to fly my airplane. This is not an airplane that you just jump in, kick the tires, light the fire, and crank her and go. And it would be interesting to see what kind of information he provided to the insurance company about recency of experience, total experience in an aircraft such as this, complex time, pilot in command, all that kind of stuff. And again, that is of great concern to me that it's not talked about in the NTSB report. And it's evident that the NTSB didn't bother to ferret that out, because that has a relationship to the causal chain of events. It is not just the engine stopped because the guy ran out of gas or had fuel starvation. And I'm afraid that the probable cause when it's issued may be too simplistic and not really identify all the key factors, causal and contributing, that we can learn from in these types of accidents.
Well, it's pretty obvious they're not going to get to the mechanical issues.
Yes.
Because they didn't dig into them here, so they don't have any basis to put that in the probable cause.
Yes.
We've done a good job on this one, I think.
It is these accidents that are ripped from the headlines, if you will, and they're tragic. But, you know, in looking at all of these key factors, this is the kind of information that for both mechanics, pilots, slash owners, that you have to think about. You may get away with it the first time. You might even get away with it the second time. But, you know, it's eventually going to catch up to you in some way, shape, or form. And a lot of times the outcome is not good. We are in aviation for a reason. If you're an aircraft owner, you can't just buy an airplane and expect that you aren't going to put money into it to ensure that it's in an airworthy condition. But the bigger thing, I think the most important thing, is the moral obligation that we all have, not only to ourselves and those that we put on that airplane, whether it's family or friends, but it's to the industry. Because when that airplane accident happens, all of a sudden we get lumped into those little airplanes will kill people. Those little airplanes are dangerous. Those little airplanes shouldn't be flying. That airport that has all those little airplanes shouldn't be open. And of course, if there is insurance, then, of course, guess who pays for it? The joy is spread amongst all of us through our own respective insurance rates. And I think that it's a disservice and it's an obligation that you can't take casually. You and I have seen accidents where we've investigated people that had more money than brains, made bad decisions because they think they could. And unfortunately, those kinds of things have caught up to them. I've already got four new accidents that we're going to dissect where pilots have bought an airplane with all the whiz-bang stuff up front, and what they lack in their own personal skills, abilities, and knowledge, they have turned that confidence over to the airplane. So they have weather, they have terrain, they have an autopilot. They basically point and shoot. Well, the problem is, airplanes will not fly through granite clouds. You still have to be a pilot. You still have to do flight planning. You still have to know that your airplane can outclimb terrain or fly above the terrain. Or it's not going to fly through weather very well if you have a level 5 thunderstorm. And those are the kinds of elements that we have to take as an industry and dissect. These loss of control accidents that they've studied forever, well, I've read some of the work done with the board and the FAA and the JSOC, which is the General Aviation Safety Committee that's studying loss of control. Some of the stuff is good, but I still don't think they've hit the nail on the head. And you and I are going to eventually dissect that because I've got that on my hit list of things for us to talk about as well.
Yeah, it's just trying times. And now with people not flying, the GA flying is way down. It's in the tank, really. In many areas of the country, we're going to have this inexperienced pilot issue come up again, if it hasn't already.
Yep. Well, John, as always, I appreciate us looking at accidents like this. You and I feel I learn something every time when we talk about these things, because one, it forces us to go beyond our comfort zone. But two, a lot of times, you and I have already seen it. It regurgitates stuff that we've kind of put to the back of our mind. But it's important, I think, for our listeners and those that are operating in the, not only in the general aviation world, but we've seen it in big airplane world as well, where, you know, there have been indictments that airline A or airline B has shortcutted maintenance for the bottom line and things like that. So it doesn't just happen to GA pilots. It happens across the board. But I think that these lessons learned, these call to actions, and of course, getting somebody to think twice before they do it is really the key. You better have a lot of confidence in your airplane, yourself, or both. And in this case, even the mechanic, before you go venturing off, because you just don't know what's going to happen. And if it does happen, are you prepared to handle it?
Yes. Fly safe means crossing all the T's and dotting all the I's, thinking.
Yeah. They're not just words on a piece of paper or somebody talking about it. I mean, you have to think about that every time you get on board an aircraft. And again, it's one thing to be by yourself and you go out and do something and put yourself in harm's way. But when you take people that are depending, I mean, just absolute with tacit trust that you're going to do the right thing every single time and you're not going to put them in harm's way. I mean, you take that down to driving. You put your family in the car. You're not going to be driving like a maniac on the highway at 90 miles an hour and endangering them. You want to do it to yourself? Have at it. But you don't have the right to do that to others. And I think, especially in an airplane, and that's the first thing I think about every time I get on an airplane with people on board. I owe it to them to do everything as best I can, as professionally as I can, even if I'm flying GA stuff.
Okay, with that, my friend, those words of wisdom.
We'll wrap it up. Well, before we do, we got to remind our listeners, you can always contact us at flightsafetydetectives@gmail.com. Give us your feedback on shows like this or any other shows, or if you have a specific accident you want us to research and dissect, we'll be happy to do that as well. Actually, I just got an email from someone who has asked me to look at a general aviation accident involving one of their family members. So I'm going to be looking at that. It could be one of those accidents that we dissect on the show. But we appreciate the feedback and everyone's support. Thank you very much for giving our show a very good rating. It's starting to ramp up to where we want to get it. And we want to take it, of course, to the next level. So again, thank you very much for that. And with that, John, I will give you the last word.
And as usual, I will say thank everybody for listening. And please fly safe. And that means planning, thinking before you get in the cockpit. And after you're in the cockpit, use your head. And have a good day. And stay safe. Not only fly safe, but stay safe in this era that we're in today.
To listen to more episodes of the show, go to FlightSafetyDetectives.com or the Professional Aviation Maintenance Association at PAMA.org and wherever you find your favorite podcasts. Catch us next time when John Golia and Greg Fife talk about all things aviation. Thanks for listening.